This is Layla Mudin, RD. I see patients every day here at the Hoffman Center. If you require a nutrition consult with me, but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.
Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin. And we are answering your questions. Questions come to us via radio program at AOL.com on email. And before we get to questions, Layla, I teased in the previous segment. Now, this is actually a term from radio, is like, and TV is tease the next story. So this is kind of a skill that they, you know, taught us at the radio station, is that you always want to keep your audience moving right along. So it's not like at the end of a segment, you don't go, okay, we're going to pause now. So stay tuned. That's kind of like old style radio. They say, coming up, the solution to Alzheimer's disease next on Intelligent. But we're not going to do that. No. But so this is the story that I was telling people about. A simple, natural way to reduce late night toilet visits. How about that? Japanese researcher. Do you feel, does that kind of draw you right in? Okay.
Yeah. I'm thinking natural way. Okay. It's not a catheter.
And it's not saw palmetto. It's actually not, you know, okay. And so you want to hear about this, right? Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
No more suspense. Headline, salt to blame for late night toilet visits, according to study. Okay. Japanese researchers at Nagasaki University, we know about Nagasaki from an unfortunate episode in history, reducing your salt intake can significantly reduce the need to wee in the night. I believe this is a story from Great Britain.
Wee in the night.
To wee in the night. A wee bit of the annoying need to pee in the middle of the night is related to the amount of salt in your diet, researchers say. Scientists in Japan have discovered that reducing your salt intake can significantly reduce the need to wee in the night. According to Dr. Matsu Tomohiro from Nagasaki University, research generally focuses on reducing the amount of water a patient drinks, and the salt intake generally is not considered. Here we have a useful study showing how we need to consider all influences to get the best chance of improving the symptoms. So they looked at 300 men and women. They found that reducing daily salt intake by 10.7 grams.
Oh, my.
Are you kidding?
10.7 grams of salt?
This is Japan.
Who's ingesting that much salt?
This is Japan.
Yeah, okay. All right. Okay.
Check this out. You reduce it by 10.7 grams to 8 grams. Now, 8 grams is about... That's about five times as much as the American Heart Association recommends.
Oh yeah,
that you consume.
Wow.
But hey, this is Japan. They use a lot of soy sauce and, you know, pickled foods.
Yep.
Anyway, they say that larger studies are needed to confirm the work, but they believe that their findings are very promising. So, you know, it makes sense, because when you consume salt or sodium, you in turn want to dilute the salt with water. So, you know, you may be chasing your tail by drinking a lot of water when you take a lot of sodium, because you're just, you know, increasing your fluid
volume. Besides the fact that it makes you thirsty. And you're going to wind up visiting the loo anyway.
Yes. Yeah. It's going to come, you know, what goes in has got to go out. You know, it's not going to stay.
Right.
So how about that strategy? All right. Listeners,
try this. I still haven't gotten past the 10 grams of salt.
It's hard to believe.
Oh, my.
But, you know, maybe this only applies to a Japanese population where they consume enormous amounts of salt. But so do we. You know, we have a lot of processed foods. So, you know, folks out there who suffer from this problem, give it a shot, you know, and, you know, see what
Give it a shot and let us know.
Yeah,
sure.
And let us know.
Yeah.
Send your observations to radioprogram@AOL.com. All right, let's take your next question.
Okay, we've got an email from Sylvia. Some time ago, I listened to one of your podcasts in which you interviewed a physician on natural treatments for neurodegenerative diseases. He talked about Huperzine A for memory, and he said that he takes it, and he notices the difference when he stops. What is your take on this, and would it be useful in older adults to prevent memory decline? If so, what dose?
Mm-hmm.
He took 200 milligrams daily.
Is that
now,
right?
Now, Dr. Hoffman, yeah, we have a product called Membrin, which contains Huperzine, but the dosage of Huperzine is 200 micrograms, not milligrams. Sylvia, is this a typo? Maybe she meant to say micrograms,
yeah,
MCG,
right. I think so.
Instead of MG, milligrams, so that might be something.
Yep. It's a cognitive enhancer. It really does work. Mm-hmm. It works on the acetylcholine pathway, which is the way many certain Alzheimer's drugs work. It's found in a Chinese plant called the club moss.
Yeah.
What else can we say about it?
Huperzine serrata, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it can, yeah. But along with other things, besides Huperzine, ginkgo biloba may be helpful for enhancing circulation. This is what's in the product Membrin. And vinpocetine. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Vinpocetine.
Vinpocetine. Yep. Thank you.
Yep.
Okay. So that can also help to...
I'm looking here at my website, which says that it's not just for the elderly. It says most clinical studies have focused on its use as a treatment for Alzheimer's disease, but there may be a beneficial effect on students as well, which is called it's a nootropic effect. This is actually interesting because more and more certain forms of competition require mental concentration rather than physical stamina. So the question will be let's say international chess competition, will Huperzine and vinpocetine and caffeine and nicotine to some extent, has also been studied along these lines, will these be outlawed?
I would throw that in.
I'm sorry?
I would also throw in phosphatidylserine.
Phosphatidylserine, sure.
Yeah.
And perhaps ginkgo, but ginkgo has more circulatory enhancing effects, which implies that in someone with normal circulation who doesn't have cerebrovascular disease, that it might be less useful. I tend to say that ginkgo is more for elder memory loss. But anyway, so... But 200 micrograms is a fairly standard dose, and it is micrograms, not milligrams.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Sylvia, it should be 200 micrograms, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Just a little review of the metric system is in order here. I mean, for those not that science-oriented, but the metric system, start with kilo. A kilo is sort of the European...
2.2
pounds. 2.2
pounds,
right?
2.2.
Then there's the gram, which is 1/1000th of a kilo. To get an idea of what a gram is, pick up one of your fish oil capsules, and there's approximately a gram of fish oil in there, or 1,200 milligrams. Again, a milligram is 1/1000th of a gram. And then take it another step further, you have 1/1000th of a milligram is 1 microgram. So let's do the math here. 200 micrograms is 0.2 milligrams, correct?
Right.
Okay.
Yes.
So, kind of be familiar with these. So, other things that are microgram amounts, another example is selenium, in contrast to other minerals like zinc, which are dosed in milligrams.
Which are in milligrams, right.
I believe.
And also, chromium is in micrograms.
Micrograms. Manganese is in micrograms.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know what? It does drives me crazy when I'm putting together a vitamin label, and sometimes it's my oversight, but sometimes the printers get it wrong, and that's a devastating error on a vitamin label that's ready to go to print, because it could mean that people read the label and they think they're getting 1,000 times more than they should be. And so we've got to get those numbers straight.
Right, right. So Sylvia, just check back with your friend that he's taking 200 micrograms.
Maybe this guy is like super rich. He's like a billionaire and he can afford that amount of, which would be the equivalent of like 1,000 pills. You know, you'd have to be a billionaire. You know, it's like.
Right. But at some point you'd have to get diminishing returns.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or too many green apples. If you eat too many green apples, you'll get a stomach ache.
Too much of a good thing is not necessarily right.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you, Sylvia, for your question.
That was very interesting, Layla. So before we get to our next question, though, I'd like to pause for a brief announcement from one of our sponsors. This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Thanks, folks, for listening, and thanks for supporting our sponsors. They're the reason that these podcasts are free and available to you.
All right. Oh, we've got an email from Larry. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, I've been cooking lately with coconut oil, but I just want to let the audience know an important tip. It's most important to order unflavored coconut oil. For instance, I do a lot of Italian-style cooking, and that coconut flavor is most unwelcome.
Sure.
People may not realize this because I noticed that most supermarkets just carry regular coconut oil. It's made a world of difference in my cooking, and I just wanted to let people know that they must order it unflavored.
Mm-hmm.
Many online health food stores sites carry it.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of people don't like sometimes with a virgin coconut oil, because it's not been refined at all, it may impart some flavor of coconut, or at least the aroma of coconut, where if he's doing any Italian-style cooking, that may not be welcome with a meatball and tomato sauce or something.
Yeah.
So that's
one way. And, you know, a couple of questions arise from this. You know, one is, why would you want to exclusively use coconut oil to the exclusion of other oils? Is there a very strong advantage? And there are certain circumstances where you like coconut oil. It's maybe got
Heat stable.
It's anti-Alzheimer's. While it is a vegetable salt,
antimicrobial. It puts you into ketosis when you take it because it's a medium chain triglyceride, which is very beneficial. And it's a very, very healthy fat.
Yeah, and I use a lot of it. But I have to say that so the other question that comes up is, in the process of deodorizing it, is something good taken away from the coconut that would be in the raw virgin coconut oil, or is there some harsh chemical process that damages the oil or adds some chemical residues to it? And I think, you know, looking at at this issue a little before this broadcast, I think they've come up with some ways to make it pretty clean. Processing is relatively minimal. You know, when we deodorize certain other vegetable oils, like canola oil is an example, we highly refine it. We take away a lot of the potential plant polyphenols that are give the aroma to olive oil. You know, we don't want to use deodorized olive oil because we'll take out all the really beneficial polyphenols, the 5-hydroxytyrosol and things like that.
Yeah, that's the difference between a good quality first cold press extra virgin olive oil versus the light olive oil that maybe some people prefer because they don't like that very strong fruity aroma or
Americans
flavor
aren't
of
used
olive
to it.
Oil.
Yeah, Americans are used to sort of bland olive oil. Yeah.
Right.
But is the situation analogous with coconut oil? And the answer is, I think an argument could be made for deodorized. I don't think it's too chemically altered because coconut is much more stable than, say, olive oil or polyunsaturated oil from safflower or something like that.
Which are very volatile.
Very volatile. Yeah. It's got double hydrogen bonds, which are stable. That's why it's called saturated. And, you know, the process that I've seen them use is a fairly clean process where they don't use a high degree of bleaching with chemicals that might leave a harmful residue. So it's okay.
Right.
I think it's okay to do that. Maybe somebody else.
And some are actually deodorizing using steam, which can remove the odor. And, you know, our odor is 70, the odor, the aroma of something is, that's, our sense of smell is 75% of our taste buds.
Right.
Removing the odor is important.
They say it comes from the pulp of the coconut as opposed to the milk of the coconut.
Yeah, the edible copra is used, they say, instead of bleach.
Okay.
And it's, copra is actually dried coconut flesh.
Okay.
But the other thing they do, that's the bleaching process that they may use, but the deodorization process is done using steam, which I think is harmless enough.
Okay.
If it's done using steam.
So I don't have a big problem with it. So, let me just say what I do. I mean, I tend to believe in a portfolio of oils so that when I'm making something where I want a Chinese flavor, I use, you know, dark sesame oil. You know, if I want Italian type stuff, you know, or Middle Eastern, I'll use olive oil. If I want a desserty kind of flavor, or if I want a Indian type flavor, I'll use coconut oil because coconut oil is a very good base for curries. And for salad dressing, I might use olive oil, or I might do some variety, like try some walnut oil. Avocado oil is nice. Macadamia nut is nice for certain things. It's a relatively neutral
I'm glad you mentioned salad dressing, Dr. Hoffman, because coconut oil is not great as a salad dressing because it's a saturated fat.
Right.
It congeals.
Yeah, sure.
You don't want to see congealed fat.
No.
You know, the way you might see on top of a pot of chicken soup that's cooled or lamb roast that you've cooled off on the countertop for a little while, that saturated fat then congeals. You don't want that in your salad.
But
coconut oil is not great for that.
I use coconut oil for my as a base for my shaving cream.
Wonderful.
And so I lubricate my face with a little coconut oil. It's you know, when it's sitting there at room temperature, it's usually solid. Like Brill cream. But when I apply it to my face, the skin is warm enough to melt it, so I get kind of a nice, slick, lubricated surface that I then put my shaving cream over. And so I get a skin treatment as well as skin lubrication with it. And it's relatively inexpensive, so I got a jar of coconut oil in my kitchen and a jar of coconut oil in my bathroom.
Yeah, yeah, me too. And, you know, oil is one of the primary cleansers. I mean, ladies, think about cold cream. You've got a lot of mineral oil in there, right? And that's what helps to remove makeup and so forth and so on. But coconut also having antimicrobial, antibacterial,
anti-acne effects.
You know, you're removing all of that from,
anti-acne effects.
Which is good.
And, you know, considering, too, that you get these little micro-abrasions when you shave, it's a way to kind of help to, you know, protect your face. So that's where I use a fair amount of it. Okay, well, I think we covered that question.
Yeah. Okay, let's see here. We've got an email from, we've got an email from Marlene. Let's see here. Hi, Dr. Hoffman. Do you think low-dose naltrexone is worth a try for a case of tinea on the feet and between the toes that has thus far not responded to topical prescription medications?
Okay. Well, just we need to start with a little definition of what low-dose naltrexone is. It's a low dose of a medication that is now being given to emergency response workers and firemen and policemen because so many people are dying of opiate overdoses these days. Do you know that the rate of opiate overdose is the highest it's ever been? You know, we tend to think of I know, the era of like maybe the 60s or something, when there were a lot of junkies, Panic in Needle Park, you know, a movie with
Al
Pacino or something.
Al Pacino, right. Yes.
It was one of his first movies. And it was like this time when New York was really grungy and people were shooting up and, you know, their cars were being broken into with junkies. Well, now it's different. I mean, there's a lot of heroin, but there's also lots and lots of Percocet, oxycodone, and aggressive marketing by many of the companies and lenient prescribing by doctors, and also an illicit market, you know, where stuff is being made outside the country and diverted, or even maybe American supplies are being illicitly hijacked and diverted. There's lots and lots and lots of people getting these drugs. So some of them are addicts, and some of them are just ordinary citizens who too readily were given a medication for, back pain or something like that, when they could have had a natural treatment. And some people, you know, can use those medications, you know, just like some people can drink a little bit and they're fine, and other people just get hooked right away. It's just some biochemical thing that some people are very vulnerable to addiction. So there's so many people who take these very powerful things, and if you shoot them, and sometimes you do to get high, it's very unpredictable. At least, I mean, heroin, straight heroin, you kind of know what you're getting. But with those things, these medications are really, really powerful. So so what we have is—
You just reminded me of the show Nurse Jackie.
Oh, yeah, right, sure.
Did you ever watch that?
Sure,
She's a nurse who's hooked on oxycodone and
oxycontin. A high-functioning addict.
Yeah, and she would crush them and snort them in the ladies' room of the hospital she worked in.
Right. So coming back to the NOG, so there's a lot of people who are ODing, and one way to literally bring somebody back to life, you know, like that scene in Pulp Fiction, you know, where the person's dying and they stab a giant, you know, 8-gauge needle into their heart. No, you just give them an injection of naloxone and they come back. So low-dose naltrexone is about a fifth as powerful as that. And of course, it doesn't have effects relating to drug addiction. But what it does is it gently reboots the immune system. And over time, it can help with autoimmunity. So it can help with possibly ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, rheumatoid arthritis, some fibromyalgia patients are getting a lot of benefit, MS patients. And then, it's one of those panacea type things that might be worth a try. But this sounds like an infection, not an inflammatory disorder, although there's an inflammatory component. So kind of a oddball question. If this patient came to me and said, nothing's curing me, would you give me a trial of low-dose naltrexone? I might say yeah, because it's a very innocuous treatment. It's relatively inexpensive, side effects minimal, doesn't create dependency, and there might be some change. I've seen it help some people with very refractory skin conditions, more like in the realm of eczema or chronic itchy skin problems and rashes. We're not be necessarily
and
versa.
Tinea is a fungus. Tinea is a fungus, so we're thinking like along the lines of a foot fungus that won't go away. And now I'm thinking.
I mean, I would think more like
scenario that this would exist is somebody with maybe a weakened immune system.
Yep.
Maybe they have a weakened immune system due to high blood sugar.
Yeah.
Maybe they have a weakened immune system for some other reason.
From your nutrition standpoint, you'd probably recommend a very low-carb, low-refined carbohydrate diet. Avoidance of sugar,
a
alcohol,
diet,
and so on.
You know. Exactly. All of that to see if that's going to help.
Yeah.
Maybe some olive leaf soap, taking olive leaf orally. Oil of oregano as well. That could be helpful.
Yeah, you have to be a little careful with applying these botanicals because you think, well, let me apply some really strong things like oregano and or rosemary oil or, you know, tinctures, essential oils, that all of these have antifungal effects, but they can also have irritant effects when they're applied undiluted to skin that's already inflamed. So you have to be careful. And, you know, sometimes in these antifungal preparations, they use a combination of an antifungal and a steroid because the antifungal will kill the fungus, but the problem is inflammation, so you also have to tame the inflammation.
Interesting. Okay.
Do you have a quick question?
As a quick question, actually, yes. Okay. Actually, yes. We've got a question here from Miriam. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, I've never heard you talk about magnesium L-threonate.
Mm-hmm.
I heard it works for calming and helping you to sleep. I also heard this goes directly to the brain. Is this true?
That's the claim. The claim with threonate is that it's, there's an issue
of the blood-brain barrier. Right.
The blood-brain barrier is sometimes difficult to breach. What you do is you tag the magnesium ion to a carrier. You know, that's why they call it chelated magnesium, and certain chelates are better absorbed than, say, magnesium oxide, which binds the magnesium very tightly and doesn't release it. So threonate is a sort of premium or expensive form of magnesium, which some studies suggest is more available to the brain. So we use a product called, Protosorb Magnesium.
Protosorb Magnesium, yes.
Protosorb, Protosorb Magnesium, which is our magnesium threonate product. And we'll use it for what? What are we using it for?
Oh, we're using it for things like anxiety, insomnia.
Yeah.
For overall sedating effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I've tried the magnesium threonate myself because I normally take magnesium taurate for mitral valve prolapse, but I said, hey, we've got this new thing, let me try it. And I noticed a difference.
Good.
I noticed a difference in I get beautifully sleepy.
Oh, okay, great. That's good.
You know that really yummy sleepiness where you just... And you just sleep so well,
Awesome.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. All right. So
I would imagine it works great for something like insomnia or something. Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing, maybe one thing one might propose that could be helpful for chronic fatigue syndrome, because there's a central aspect to it that some of we tend to feel to some extent it's in the muscles or in the body, but actually, lack of proper brain activation may be an element in it. And the brain, all the metabolic processes are governed by magnesium. So if you can get magnesium into the brain, you can make ATP better. ATP is the energy compound that drives brain cells and brain function. So, that's where we use it when brain is consideration. If it's people with muscle cramps or generalized body fatigue, we might use jigsaw magnesium. If it's heart, magnesium taurate, blood pressure, magnesium taurate, arrhythmias, magnesium taurate.
Mm-hmm. Magnesium citrate for constipation.
Constipation, right? Excellent for that.
And magnesium glycinate, particularly for muscle cramping, may be helpful.
Something new that I'm using is for athleticism. When I go to a spin class, I put some ice in a bottle and add some water, but it's a little boring. So what I've done is I've added something called reacted magnesium. It's made by Orthomolecular, and it's got a sweet taste, but it's made with this type of stevia that is the best stevia I've ever had, because stevia tends to be a little bitter, leave a bitter aftertaste. And it's non-caloric, and it gives you a pretty good dollop of magnesium. And, of course, when you sweat and you work out, you're going to become depleted in magnesium. So I find that is a way that I can hydrate and get the benefits of magnesium in a powder. Just put a half of a scoop of that into a water bottle, and that's what I work out with now. So
terrific.
I'm trying out, stay tuned, folks, because I'm trying out a new workout product that I may share with you, but it's on my radar screen, and I'm self-testing it out. But I'll share it with you later.
Ah, another teaser.
Another tease, Stay tuned.
Okay. Stay tuned.
All right. Thanks for joining us. And I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And this
Thank you, everybody.
Intelligent Medicine Podcast.